This week, Cleena and I spoke to Mr. Mike Carter, consultant paediatric neurosurgeon at Bristol Children's Hospital. Mike spoke about his route into paediatric neurosurgery, the challenges of work, both physical and cognitive, in theatre, and the influence of technology on his work.
So welcome to the Neuro Clinic. It's a pleasure, Mike. It's been long in the pipeline. Pleasure to have Mr. Mike Carter here, who's a paediatric neurosurgeon in Bristol, where I work. So we bump into each other fairly regularly, don't we, Mike?
We certainly do, in the corridor and in Costa Coffee, and every now and then a multidisciplinary team meeting for epilepsy.
And right here, right now, in the Neuro Clinic podcast. And
absolutely, what an honour.
We have Cleena Carroll. Cleena, do you want to say hello? It's the second time we've done a podcast together, isn't it?
It is. And it's really nice to meet you, Mike. And I'm really fascinated in hearing more about your journey into neurosurgery and also hearing about neurosurgery. I was saying to Ingram earlier, I watch a lot of Grey's Anatomy. So that's my reference point neurosurgery.
Yeah.
So, Mike, we, as you know, we usually start by asking our guests to burden themselves with having to introduce themselves. So, are you happy to kick us off?
I certainly am. Well, Ingram, as you know, I've got a number of identities: dad, dog owner, musician, glider pilot. But I guess the identity you're most interested in is me, as in a professional context. So, I'm Mike Carter, and I'm a consultant neurosurgeon here at Bristol Children's Hospital. And I've been working in Bristol since 2004 as a consultant neurosurgeon. And I've been specializing specifically in peds and doing a lot of pediatric epilepsy surgery since we moved to the Children's Hospital in our current iteration of the service in 2014.
Mike, can I ask you a little bit about your journey into neurosurgery? Because
sure.
I guess in neuropsychology, there's, you know, adult neuropsychology, pediatric neuropsychology. Yeah. So I'd really love to hear about your journey, but also what's the difference? Is it just the size of a brain?
Oh, that's a whole podcast all on its own. But my way in, how did I get into this crazy mad thing? Well, maybe it won't surprise you to know that there was a kind of like a wild and exciting uncle involved in all of this. My uncle Gopal, in fact, he wasn't my uncle at all, but he grew up on the same rubber plantation that my grandparents took care of in Malaysia in the 1940s. So he's always adopted the role of kind of like honorary uncle in my life. And he was exciting for all kinds of reasons. But his career path took him from University of Malaysia to the London Hospital in the early 1960s. And then from the London Hospital to a consultant job in neurosurgery in Edinburgh in the 70s, and from there back to Singapore as a consultant neurosurgeon at the National University of Singapore. And he was always very high in the mix in my extended Indian family. And he was extremely funny, highly charismatic, an absolute rogue in most ways. And he kind of had it in his mind. He loved neurosurgery, there's no doubt about that. He loved many, many things as well. He latterly became quite a prominent writer, actually, funny enough, a fiction in the Far East, and was well recognized for that. But he had it in mind from a very early stage that that's what I should probably do. And I remember visiting Singapore when I was about 10 or 11 years of age, and we did many interesting things, including looking for otters various other things. But we one of the things we did is we went to his neurosurgical unit in his hospital, and we went into theatres with me at age 10. And he sat me down with the operating microscope, and we spent an afternoon cutting pieces of polythene into little tiny 1 millimetre wide squares with micro instruments. So that was fascinating to me, and it was the first introduction really to another world, not least of which the micro world, which we use microscopes for virtually everything in neurosurgery, and it's a very interesting perspective on the world, actually. And it got me interested at an early stage. And I remember that was quite a big hit, that whole trip, for all kinds of other reasons. And I remember getting back to England, and just before the summer holiday, just before Christmas, I got a letter from him saying, "Well, it's lovely to see you in Singapore, and I do hope you consider, you know, the career in neurosurgery very strongly." And that was at age 11. So we didn't specifically talk about it much, actually, over the next decade and a half, I guess. Actually, I hadn't really intended to go into medicine, to be quite honest with you. My interest was in the natural world, and I'd actually, you know, at the age of 18, I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to St. Catherine's College in Oxford, and indeed started there. Started with a statistics course, which started right after the end of school, right at the beginning of that wonderful 18-year-old vacation, summer vacation you're supposed to have between school and university. And I went to Oxford and spent 3 or 4 weeks struggling really with basic statistics, and came to me very quickly that actually this wasn't what I'd signed up for, and it's not what I thought zoology was going to be about at all. And in fact, via a number of other intermediary stages, including a girlfriend who was doing medicine, I kind of switched streams, and at the end of the summer holidays that September, found myself at Southampton University Medical School as a first year in medical studies. And that's where the medical side of it started. And neurosurgery was always kind of there in the background. And certainly in Southampton, it was fascinating because the Wessex Neuro Unit was a separate part of the hospital down a long cork floored corridor that smelled of carbolic, all kinds of other weird things. And you didn't really go down there very much. It was generally felt to be a bit risky and inhabited by these strange consultant neurosurgeons who really at the time really were pretty strange. And and so it was always kind of the forbidden fruit as well. Anyway, you know, when you're an undergraduate in medicine, you tend to like everything that you did. And I went through the whole thing of loving pediatrics and, you know, obstetrics and psychiatry and all these things. But I kind of, by the time I'd done my pre-registration house jobs, I realized that I was a surgical doing being rather than a kind of thinking being, I think, probably. So I kind of went off down a program of jobs that took me to a training in general surgery. And really at that point, when I'd got my fellowship at the Royal College of Surgeons, such as it was back in the days, the world was open to me. And I remember thinking about my options and picking up a beautifully illustrated book of neurosurgery from somewhere in Germany that had the most incredible line drawings in it. And, you know, it demonstrated the beautiful structures in the brain that really have their own taxonomy and naming system, all of their own, you know, Ammon's horn, the insula, the amygdala, you know, all these places, forceps major, forceps minor, you know, interthalamic adhesion, all these things you never really heard about in medical school. And these beautiful descriptions of how you would find such things if you, you know, went down the Sylvian fissure, for example, and separated the frontal and temporal lobes and created a corridor.
And there was I with the front cover of The Hobbit.
Thinking. Yeah. Neuropsychology in The Hobbit.
Was Rivendell.
So there we go. So that's how it was. And, you know, the funny thing was is that I was actually fairly advanced down the general surgical training pathway, mainly because I hadn't made a choice about what I was going to do before I decided to spend 6 months as a locum registrar in neurosurgery in Manchester, which I absolutely adored. Tried to get on the training scheme, such as it was back then, in Manchester, failed, came back down to Southampton, spent another 6 months as locum registrar, and was taken on as a regional vocational trainee. And I finished that. I went through the program there, spent a little bit of time in Copenhagen on an exchange visit, which was fantastic, and emerged, you know, sort of like fully trained up and ready to go in 2001. And I was lucky enough to secure a training fellowship at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, where I went and spent a fantastic year doing pediatric neurosurgery in what is really the preeminent neurosurgical unit in the world, I think. And then did another 18 months doing tumor research into a variety of brain tumors called ependymomas that I'd done some genetics work in previously. And from there was lucky enough to be offered a job in Southampton, which I took. So, sorry, in Bristol, which I took. And, you know, so January 2004, I turned up.
And I suppose a cleaner's question, you acknowledge the probably a huge one, but pediatric neurosurgery versus adult neurosurgery. I mean, presumably there is the fork in the road was fairly early on, was it?
It's interesting. I think that the emergence of pediatric specialities is something that's been, I guess, more accentuated over the past 10 to 15 years or so. Certainly when I was coming through the system, it wasn't really so strong. And I remember that when I was a trainee, you know, there weren't pediatric neurosurgeons per se. in most neurosurgical units in the United Kingdom. And people did adult work and they did pediatric work when it came through the door as well. And most general hospitals or most university hospitals would have a segment of a neurosurgical unit that had, you know, a few children's beds in it. And that was the neurosurgical unit. It was only really Great Ormond Street in London that was a dedicated pediatric neurosurgical practice. So it was an interesting thing. One of the things I found about pediatric neurosurgery when I was training as a registrar was that I actually liked the environment very much, and I found that I functioned very well in the kind of somewhat morally stressed, shall we say, environment of families with very sick children. I wasn't terrified of it, and I found that I could communicate in that environment very well and establish very effective, or so I thought, working relationships, and it worked well for me. And in fact, most people did not like that. They did not like the environment. They did not like the kind of moral commitment of it in a lot of ways, and they didn't like what was perceived as the risk of it and the high expressed emotion involved in most of it. And so it created a kind of natural space which I, you know, kind of like navigated myself towards. And in fact, you know, I guess the defining moment was when I decided that maybe I should follow a career that was, you know, involved a lot of pediatric work, and even consider getting a job somewhere like Great Ormond Street, where I do mostly that. And that's what took me to Toronto. And I was very lucky to get the slot in Toronto that I did, because it was very last minute. Fortunately, somebody from the Israeli army dropped out of a kind of like an eponymous named fellowship. And I took it, and that's where it all started, really.
It sounds, it's fascinating. It's really fascinating to hear your story as well. Yeah. I've really heard you kind of talking about, you know, you mentioned epilepsy, you mentioned brain tumors, particular types of brain tumors, but you've talked about working with the families and kind of that distress kind of in managing people, like young kids, like kind of with neurosurgical needs. What does a neurosurgeon do all day, Mike?
That's a very good question. I mean, ideally, you spend a relatively high proportion of your time actually in direct clinical contact with patients, which means either, you know, supervising them and their families on wards, or talking to them in clinics, or communicating with them via, you know, meetings online, as we do increasingly these days, or indeed operating. And when you're not doing that, ideally you're doing a little bit of admin and spending time doing academic things, writing things up, reading, thinking, talking to colleagues in different parts of the world. That's ideally what you would be doing. In the modern days NHS, it's not quite like that anymore, because we are very resource limited and have been for quite a while. And the emphasis in public run systems has, to a large extent, I think, sort of like tipped in favor of the development and support of kind of bureaucratic hierarchies in the system, which we are very subservient to in many ways. And it sits ill with many of us, I think. But certainly, that aside, I mean, the guts of my work, I think, is and always will be clinical. You know, it's talking to people and meeting new families at, you know, very stressful times of their lives, and you know, guiding them through what comes next, which is often, you know, high degrees of physical violence in some senses, you know, towards their beloved children. And, you know, I think, you know, the ability to establish a healing relationship, which is basically what any of this is about, is very key in that. And it's a very lovely thing if you feel up to it. And that's certainly what I've tried to do.
Mike, I suppose we've worked together, I suppose. I've seen, witnessed your interactions with patients, and you're clearly very good at developing rapport with children and with the wider family system.
Thank you.
It must be hard moving from that sort of more relational space outside theatre into a neurosurgical, technical neurosurgical relationship with a patient. I mean, do you experience a shift as you move from outside the theatre into the physical environment?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think there are lots of places where there would be, you know, obvious sort of like areas where things change, if you want, you know, obvious barriers that you have to surpass or go through in order to get to the next stage sort of thing. But in a lot of ways, I try and keep it all very much the same. Like, for example, I mean, one of the classic differentiations that most clinicians have is between the patients and us. So they're the patients and we're us. Well, how about if you turn it on its head and you say, we're all people, you know, and that is actually something that I've cultivated from a very early stage. And that's my starting point, actually, you know, And it's good in some ways because it kind of keeps it real and it makes the communications more authentic in some senses and heartfelt. And I think people respond that to that very strongly. And I think that, you know, the where the magic happens in medicine is always in the healing relationship that you develop, not the lasers that you use or the computers that you bring to bear or any of these amazing, wonderful things that we have in our, you know, with our armamentarium in order to operate on kids. It's more about where you kind of like place all these things in a wider context of healing and well-being, you know. So I think that going back to your question about how does this change, I think that obviously it's a difficult thing to have somebody who's, you know, you regard very much as an equal and as, you know, of flesh and blood like you, and then to take them into theaters, anesthetize them and drill enormous holes in their head, take off chunks of skull and remove bits of brain. Well, it's an interesting thing. It's to do such a thing is in some sense is very depersonalizing. And I think most surgeons would say that there's a degree of depersonalization necessary to do that. I'm not sure if I entirely agree with that. You know, it's one of the funniest things, but going back to the microscope thing that I was telling you about, but when you're operating on deep in somebody's brain, okay, and you're looking down the eyepieces of one of the wonderful, super high tech, very expensive 3D microscopes that we do now, and you have the impression that you're right actually in the middle of somebody else's brain, and it feels like that. It feels like it. You feel surrounded by it, and your sensorium responds to that sensation, and in fact your movements adjust to it. You know, it's about as intimate as you can possibly be with another human being, actually, in a funny sense. You know, so on the one hand there's a degree of depersonalization, but there's another kind of elevation in that, which is kind of like intense intimacy. So I think you shuttle backwards and forwards across that frontier, you know, all the time.
At the risk of sounding like a psychologist, Mike, what what are the thoughts and feelings that go through your mind as you're, you know, engaging in that, you know, highly technical task, like kind of deep, intimate in someone's brain?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing. The day starts off, you know, in a very stylized sort of way. You know, we generally see our patients in the morning before surgery, and then we do the consent, other bits of paperwork need doing, say our last minute bits and pieces. We tend to have gone through most of the talking bit before that point, because you're not really in the headspace that wants to go through risks and stuff right then. And then we meet in theatres and we have a brief where the team kind of equates itself with each other, and we set out the store for the day. And then, you know, we call for our first patient, and the patient arrives in theatre and gets sent to sleep. And usually after you've said goodbye to the parents and sort of like ushered them out of the room, and then you have this living, breathing, unconscious, warm person that you have to maneuver carefully onto an operating table and sort of restrain, usually in a very aggressive looking 3-pin headrest that kind of like engages in their skull, and you set up your guidance, and bit by bit, you know, they become, I guess, less of an obvious person as you put drapes on and, you know, clean their skin and draw lines and stuff. And then when you kind of like, it's interesting, you kind of like feel, at least I do, I try to make myself very aware of the fact that we're putting someone to the edge of the knife here. And that's actually quite a big thing to do, you know, even though we do it all the time and we're normally there, you know, there's a profound respect for the integrity of the human being, I think, amongst most people who practice surgery. And I think to, you know, once you cut skin, you've kind of, it's very transgressive in some ways, but then this tremendous sense, I think, of purpose and sort of progressively of intimacy with that person that you're operating on becomes very, very strong, actually, and very dominant. It does for me anyway. I mean, it's quite a thing to feel someone's, you know, blood on your hands, and to feel, you know, the spurting warm blood coming out of vessels, and, you know, to feel their tissues pulsing beneath you, you know. And what do you end up doing as the operation progresses? You kind of get involved in this intense and fiercely aware kind of awareness, I would say, intensely aware sort of like consciousness of everything that's going on, really. And things like time sort of like tend to slowly slide away from you as you get more and more involved in this. And certainly by the time you've gone through the technical parts of an operation, for example, you know, opening the skull and placing the retractors, you know, and you introduce the microscope and you're sitting down in this strange place that actually feels like you're in the middle of someone's brain, sitting there within them sort of thing, you know, it's this intense concentration that really takes over everything and time changes and you don't notice the passage of time, but all kinds of odd, you know, synchronicities turn up. You know, for example, I remember, I don't know if you've ever watched that wonderful film about Chris Kyle, American Sniper, and there's a wonderful scene in this where Chris Kyle is learning how to snipe and his instructor is saying, you know, you will find that you synchronize your breathing with that of your victim and you will find the respiratory pause to take the shot. And, you know, you kind of do that when you're operating on a living brain because it pulses, you know, it pulses and you have to adapt your micro movements in, you know, under times 30 micro magnification, whatever, to that microscopic movement you're seeing in front of yourself. So you become cognizant of that and you kind of align yourself with it. Likewise, the respiratory rate changes the way in which the brain looks. It goes up and down a little bit with the respiratory pattern. And so there are all these things that unconsciously you kind of like lock into and, you know, become synergistic with. It's really strange. And then it's one of those strange things where you just complete micro task after micro task after micro task after micro task without being aware of fatigue, without being aware of fear, mainly without being aware of the outside world. And you just keep on doing it. And, you know, it's very strange when you finish at the end of an operation to realize sometimes that you've been doing this relentlessly without considering anything else for maybe 12 or 15 hours, you know, and it's a shock to you. It's like, you know, falling asleep in hibernation and waking up in spring, and that huge amount of time has passed, but actually you've not really been aware of the passage of time. You know, a lot of stages have been completed and you're now at your place, but it's a very odd headspace that you enter. You know, it's one of these really strange things. And like, It's strange how everything else leaves your mind as well. You know, usually when somebody says to you, you know, try not to think of it or don't think of an elephant, you know, all you can think about is a bloody elephant, right? Well, if you're actually under the microscope doing something, you know, engrossing, then somebody could say, don't think about an elephant, and you wouldn't. It's very strange.
It's interesting what you say about time.
I
had the privilege of being in theatre with you and doing various operations. And I think the first time I went in, I put 2 hours on the parking meter and thought we'd all be done by lunchtime.
Yeah.
And still there standing up at 6 o'clock thinking, how on earth can you do it physically? And I recognise in you, I mean, obviously I'm stepping back from the sharp end of things, but there is quite a significant physical demand, right?
So very much so.
Time, the prolonged periods of concentration, but also notice there are periods of time where you're able to sing and listen to music and do other things as well.
There's
less technically involved, less critical phases, right? Is that when you're resting, or is there no such thing as rest?
No, I think there are just phases of it. I mean, yeah, I've probably slightly over-egged it in terms of describing the Zen-like state, but, you know, there are moments when it is very much like that. But, of course, I mean, you're not unresponsive. You know, something starts bleeding. You've got to adapt very quickly to that. And indeed, we do. Mm. And, you know, all the time things like that happen. And, yes, there are moments when you back off and take a breath. And, indeed, there might be spontaneous songs or laughter or whatever. There's a lot of music always. And that's generally a calming influence, I think, in operating theatres everywhere. But it is a very strange thing. I mean, I think the majority of it is still in a very odd headspace that is quite unlike anything else I've ever encountered, actually. It's very odd, you know, and you're right about the physical side of it. I mean, sometimes you finish an operation, you can, you know, the first thing you notice is that when you turn the microscope off, you can't see anything because you've got snow blindness. You've been looking, you know, super powerful, you know, ultraviolet rich light for the best part of 12 hours. And, you know, your retina is completely saturated. You can't see a bloody thing for 10, 15 minutes. It's really strange. And then you try to start walking around and you realize your back really hurts and your legs really stiff. And, you know, you go and have a pee and, you know, what comes out looks like treacle because you've not drunk anything maybe for, you know, half a day. So yes, it takes an enormous amount of physical, you know, physical presence, I think, and physical strain and stress in order to do these things. But it is quite, it's a crazy sort of thing. And the passage of time and the kind of aberrant passage of time is something that never ceases to amaze me in this whole thing. It really doesn't.
I feel incredibly grateful, Mike, for having this conversation with you. And I can imagine, you know, some of the listeners to our podcast will feel quite similar, I think. I guess there's some similarities to an extent, I would add. Like, I'm sitting here thinking, oh, I really want to do like a study now looking at the neuropsychological functioning of neurosurgeons, because
you should. It's very interesting.
What impeccable kind of executive functioning, attentional tasks, but also that ability to protect and dissociate almost from the from everything else except the job at hand, isn't it?
I don't know how it happens, Clina. I really don't. I mean, because, you know, I don't know how we learn this, or whether we naturally do it, or maybe it's like being a sheepdog. You just kind of do it, you know, because you're inclined that way. But it's, when we talk, Ingram and I shared a pint a little while ago in the pub, and we talked about all kinds of interesting spin-offs of this whole thing where time seems to be suspended. And one of the things about that is that, of course, if there's no time, then the concept of causality falls apart, because there is no cause and no effect, because what happens first? So where does that put you in everything? I don't know. It's very interesting.
And I guess, like you spoke about, you know, families kind of feeling distressed that before going for surgery is not the time to be kind of gaining consent.
No.
Like, for time standing still for you, I wonder what that experience is like for the families, and what I don't know whether there's a set, again, my reference point is Grey's Anatomy. It's I'll go and update the family. You know, does that happen?
Yeah, it does. And I can tell you exactly what it's like for the families. And, you know, I've been parent of a child that's needed, you know, major surgery for it. And, you know, what happens is that time does stand still, and every minute takes a year. Mm. But unlike my case, you know, when you're doing the surgery, you're kind of like in this wonderful kind of like exalted state, almost a rapture of some sorts. And, you know, when you're the parent, you're not. It's very, very, very painful. Mm. You can't stay still. You have to walk around, and you drink tons of coffee, and you know, go out of the hospital, go to Waitrose and come back again, and it's still going on. And for that reason, you know, we try as much as possible to give people updates, not because there's anything, you know, technically accurate about that usually, but just to reestablish, you know, touch base and just say that things are okay, we're making progress sort of thing, is I think it's tremendously sustaining.
Yeah, I think Rob Delaney, the comedian, kind of I don't know if you've read his book, but
I haven't read his book, but I've read a lot about it. Yeah,
I think kind of like he talks about that quite a bit, that sense of like kind of what him and his wife did. And, you know, there's a whole bit in the book about them going and having sex kind of whilst waiting for their child to come out of neurosurgery. And it's that sense, like you use the word intimacy, like kind of there is something about this, you know, this intimacy in that moment, isn't there? And that trust in somebody else to look after your child. And
yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, sometimes we forget, we get so tied up in the difficulties in providing the service, and there's a lot of angst around that at the moment. Just what a tremendous thing this is, not least because of what we manage to do these days. You know, we regularly go up against the odds where we shouldn't win, but we do anyway. Mm. And we do it time after time after time after time. And, you know, that's quite something to be able to say that. I don't mean me personally. I mean, you know, as a speciality in a group, it's like that. But, you know, I think that I don't know. It's a tremendously, I mean, as you were saying, I mean, how do you get a family who you've never met before to agree to let you do something as appalling as a neurosurgical operation on their child? Mm. I don't know how you do it. But, you know, I personally, in my experience, I don't think I've ever known a time when somebody hasn't. And that is in and of itself quite incredible. And I'm not quite sure where that tremendous faith and belief comes from. I guess part of it is the healing relationship, because I'm sure you could certainly say and do things that would make people not want to let your child be operated on by you. But it's very rare that patients take that line. They demonstrate, and patients, their families demonstrate tremendous faith and kind of collective optimism in a way that's incredible, really. It makes you think, if we were able to do that with each other at times other than stressful times like that, well, how the world would be different, you know?
Mike, I suppose one of the things, before we kind of leave the theatre environment and maybe talk about some broader interfaces, I've always been struck when I've been in theatre with you about how the choreography between the various people in the room works. I think I know kind of who's who. It takes a little time to work out, but it's quite interesting how it does feel like there's a dance going on within the team as well. And I suppose I wondered if you had any thoughts or comments about the importance of that teamwork. And we've talked about this a bit, haven't we? And
I'm
sort of fascinated to see a good team working in that kind of environment, but also spotting sometimes when things aren't quite working.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know how conspicuous that can be.
We've both had experience of that, haven't we? I remember that, but it's interesting. You know, the theatre environment is a very, very strange one. And, you know, if you've not experienced it, I strongly recommend you do, and you're very welcome to come down and join us.
I'll be there, Mike.
Thumbs up. Yeah, absolutely. You really should. And Ingram, you're very welcome to come back whenever you want. It's always very entertaining having you there. You know, it's a strange thing. I think a lot of people are surprised by how many people there are in theatres. Did that surprise you, Ingram?
You know, yeah, the whole thing is somewhat mind-blowing. I remember the first time going into theatre and Mike had obviously done the craniotomy and was pointing out an interesting part of the surface of the cortex. And I was just, my mind was blown by the space we were in and the people in the space and the child on the table, but under wraps. It's an amazing experience. I mean, I would urge Clina to take up that invitation because I think there's nothing like it. And I suppose from my perspective, Mike, one of the things that I had reservations about is this is an intimate moment. It's a necessary relationship between you and the child. My presence on most occasions, except when we've done WADA procedures and things like that, that you know are in the same kind of space, my presence is surplus to requirements. And I feel... Yeah. I had to rationalize, wrestle with what is it that I'm doing there? And my rationale would be I'm trying to understand the neurosurgical work, right? So given that we work alongside neurosurgeons, we kind of need to understand who they are, what they do and what it means and what the risks are. And I think outside of theater, I mean, we work together in epilepsy surgery and, you would regularly talk about the risks of a particular procedure in a particular child. And we discuss as a team the costs and benefits of a surgical procedure. I think for me, understanding a little bit about what those risks translate into in terms of the technical aspects of the procedure is incredibly, incredibly helpful.
I think it's very helpful, I think always, you know, to understand that in people particularly whose background is, you know, whose professional role is largely discussive, if you want to see that, you know, how it works for those of us where we at the very sharp end where, you know, a group decision becomes me incising someone's flesh with a laser, right? I mean, that's quite a shocker, you know, and I think it is very important to see that. And I think, you know, the response you describe is very common for people visiting theatres for the first time. And I've had many people that have come in, including people who I thought would be, you know, very eminent researchers and people who are quite used to dealing with the concept of, you know, clinical risk and, you know, the transgressive nature of operations. It's very common for people to be in absolute tears afterwards. And, you know, quite a few prominent people, including politicians, have been that way. And they're not entirely able to explain why, but I think I kind of know, you know. But
up to process, isn't it?
I think it brings you up short. It puts you in a space that you're not prepared for in any sense, probably. I think that's what that represents. And it is overwhelming. And, you know, just going back to Ingram's original question about, you know, the theatre environment, you know, it's very common for us to have maybe 17 people in theatres during a procedure. Easily possible if we, you know, we have a big anaesthetic team, you know, and if the case is a very big or risky one or the patient is very, very small, the anaesthetic team can easily be four people plus the, you know, the anaesthetic nurse that's there or the anaesthetic assistant. And then we have the theatre scrub team, which will be three or four people, including a runner. And then there will be at least one surgeon, but more likely two or three. And, you know, possibly a whole bunch of observers and learners and watchers from various specialities, nurses from the wards. If we're doing intraoperative monitoring, then we have the neurophysiology team there as well. So it can easily rack up to be enormous numbers of people. And this is a rather kind of like unruly, if happy, band that you take along with you on this this rather wild journey. And I suppose in a sense, you know, there is a kind of rough hierarchy of sorts. In fact, there are several intersecting hierarchies, actually. There's a whole bunch of Venn diagrams in there. But I guess as the, you know, as a consultant surgeon in an environment like that, you are kind of like, you know, you're kind of like a, you know, loosely the captain of this bunch of, you know, this this bunch of fine fellows, as it were. And, you know, you have power of veto over virtually anything, be it music or whether we give blood or not, or what we do now.
And I suppose my sense of that dance, Mike, is that at least in terms of what I've seen you do, there is an implicit hierarchy, but you... I've not seen that made explicit in the theatre environment. There doesn't
I don't think you need to raise voices or
needs to be critical or things are done quicker. It's very much a non-verbal sort of very subtle signalling that goes on.
Yeah, it's like a whole bunch of cats. You know, everyone kind of knows more or less what everyone else is thinking. You know, may sit on a wall or jump off and, you know, smell poo or something, but they all more or less move in the same direction. And I guess, you know, the team is an interesting thing because, you know, there are teams within teams, but most of the people who do this kind of hyper-specialist work will know each other and will probably have known each other for a very long period of time. And as you know, in the epilepsy surgery group, I mean, it's a wonderful team, I feel, and I think that we do know each other very well and respect each other as people and as friends, as well as professional colleagues. And I think that, you know, one of the things I've striven for in that is an extremely flat hierarchy, which is, I think, exactly what we've ended up with. And it works brilliantly. Everyone's empowered. Nobody feels afraid to speak. No one's disrespectful. We don't ever have shouting matches or people calling each other names, which I can tell you happens all the time in the NHS, which on the whole is a tremendously bullying and aggressive environment, I have to say. The none of epilepsy surgery team is not like that. And I think if I've achieved anything in my professional life, it's been encouraging it to grow in a kind of... you know, a mutually synergistic sort of way, really. And I think we've done that. And that's what we see in theatres too. The tenor of things changes very rapidly in theatres as well. And what you find with a good team is everybody kind of picks up with that and kind of the whole swarm shifts 3 degrees to the right just like that without even thinking about it, you know. Yeah. It's like being a fish in a large shoal or a starling in a murmuration. It's just like that. You know, it's how it feels. And it's very strange.
Many of our listeners are neuropsychologists or want to be neuropsychologists or are on the journey to be neuropsychologists. Without embarrassing me too much, Mike, with how do you find the relationship between neurosurgery and neuropsychology?
I think it's wonderful. I love it. I think we should have more of it. I think that our interactions are fun, informative, very patient-centered. Delightfully offbeat a lot of the time. You guys on the whole are very aware people, or intelligent people, and you know a lot. You know a lot about things that I'm interested in as well, you know, and I think that our interactions have been revelation, really, in a lot of ways. I mean, I think that, you know, working in epilepsy surgery, I'm very lucky to have such access to neuropsychological colleagues because you so very much a part of the team that we work in and what you contribute to patient assessment and, you know, is vital in determining, you know, that the advisability of the procedures we undertake or not, as the case may be, and making the case for, you know, sort of like the timing of where we do things. And, you know, I think that you have a great role as well in ministering to the patients and to generating the healing environment, if you want, which I think is very important of this whole thing, and managing patient expectations and what have you, and to a certain extent being there to help pick up the pieces when it all goes a little bit Pete Tom, which he does sometimes, in any case, actually. And I think that it's been a fantastic thing. And I've been it's been one of the great joys, actually, having neuropsychology on the team.
Mike, it's great to hear about, I guess, your view of what the added value of neuropsychology is to the to the process. And, you know, you mentioned that idea about kind of timings of interventions, being able to support, help them with complexity, chaos, probably family systems, I think a little bit as well. This is my hat. I come as somebody who has worked generally in the community and community rehab with people kind of further down the line, so not necessarily in that acute way. I wondered what your view is around the role of neurosurgery and the interactions between neurosurgery and neuropsychology kind of further down the pathway for young people.
Well, I think there's plenty of room there for interaction. As I say, you know, particularly in the modern kind of task-orientated, cost-orientated world, it's very, I think, common to think about surgical interventions as being a little bit like episodes of clutch repair, you know. You turn up and somebody changes a washer and off you go and that's it. Ba-doom. You know, but, you know, as I said before, you know, where the magic happens is in a far more kind of diffuse and almost abstract relationship, which I call the healing relationship, which has many components to it. And I think that you know, this healing relationship is fundamentally one between, I guess, or I experience it this way, as between as being between a surgeon and, well, in my particular situation, the surgeon, a clinician, if you want, and the patient and the family they look after. And it, you know, it goes onwards into the future optimally, way beyond the intervention that you make. And, you know, I certainly, back in the day when one was at liberty to follow people as one did, I often followed patients for many years after we'd done whatever we were going to do, just because that was actually part of the fix, you know. And one of the great joys about being a consultant is that you can kind of bring other people into this kind of this mix as well, if you want. And I think that working as part of the epilepsy surgery team, which is a very big group of professionals, you know, we're accompanied on this journey by our wonderful colleagues from nursing and from psychology and psychiatry, and indeed even our coordinator, who very often forms quite close relationships with families. You know, we're empowered and enabled to kind of take this on into the future, way beyond the direct therapeutic input that we've done. And I think that really is where the magic happens, funny enough. It's so important. And I think that we are moving so far away from healing relationships and interactions that actually produce wellness in our model world. I think it's very sad, actually, you know. I sometimes wonder about the value of high intensity interventions, and really the picture is so much broader than that.
So looking at that long term outcomes, really, isn't it? Like, on which a lot of kind of childhood illness. But now, and a lot of the focus of research is on the long term outcomes, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's an interesting thing. Epilepsy has been a wonderful kind of like palette to paint with, I think, because there are so many great unknowns about it. It affects us in so many different ways, and the interventions are so interesting. And in fact, the assessments and workup and appraisal of patients and families is such an interesting thing as well. And of course, in epilepsy surgery, one of the things that's really struck me, and I think this, you know, accords with the greater world of epilepsy and epilepsy management, is that actually assessing outcomes in terms of response to anti-seizure treatments is actually a very difficult thing to do. And in fact, you know, the old-fashioned way of a diarized series of numeric, you know, representations of seizures before and seizures out before actually often makes very little sense at all. And in fact, a far better metric is actually a wider inventory looking at kind of quality of life outcomes, you know, afterwards. And in fact, we've been working on this. We put a lot of these devices called vagal nerve stimulators in, as you know, which been contentious for quite a long while, but they do seem to have some sort of effect. But the interesting thing is that the appreciation of the intervention, you know, by the patients is somewhere in the region of 99.9999%. You know, people absolutely love it for their children. And but when you look at the actual effect it has on numeric seizures, it's modest. You know, 50% of people get a 50% or greater improvement in seizure frequency or severity. So effectively achieving some sort of palliation in about a quarter of the people we implant. So if that's the case, why does everyone love it? Well, there's lots of reasons for it. I mean, I'm just looking at the demographics, one thing. I mean, that's one of the things we don't really do very often. But so many of our families, you know, they're single parent families living in rural environments, on benefits with a fitting child. So, you know, the opportunity to speak to a team, you know, on a regular basis when things are going wrong is manna from heaven, I would imagine, in that environment. You know, the fact that a vagus nerve stimulator can be activated by the parent themselves if they feel that seizures are about to start or have started, you know, they can swipe a magnetic, you can physically do something that makes a difference to your child's well-being. You know, the fact that you interact on a regular basis with the organization, then you can turn things up or down. I mean, it's tremendously interesting. Now, how do you capture all that? Don't really know. I mean, we've been using the Qualify5 thing, as you know, Ingram, for a while now, trying to get people to, you know, report their out. It's difficult to do because it's not funded, this kind of research. We're just doing it because we're interested, really. But, you know, I think that what it is we achieve out of these interventions is something that needs to be really, really examined, actually, you know.
Michael, one of the questions I suppose have for you, and I'm sort of wanting to kind of take you back to the 10-year-old boy watching his uncle, you know.
Yeah.
Cutting up bits of polythene.
Yeah.
Technology. You mentioned the microscopes and robots and all other things. I suppose I do wonder how you perceive that in terms of your career. And as the technology comes in, I suppose I'm struggling now to understand my mobile phone and TV remote because they seem to be changing quicker than I can keep up. I mean, is there a sense that the technology is racing forward, and there's quite a challenge in the neurosurgical field to kind of keep up with what it can bring you.
I think it is racing forward, and you know, we are empowered to look at the body, central nervous system, the cell, you know, the function of the central nervous system, the function of the cell, in ways that we have never been able to before. I mean, the quantum leaps engendered by the changes in imaging, electrophysiology, that the tremendous processing capacity that we have now to look at data, to turn it from one form into another, from, you know, figurative data into visible data, is something that none of us could really have imagined 20 years ago. I mean, I remember thinking what an amazing thing a CT scanner was once, you know, look through bone and you can see slices of the brain. Well, CT scanners, like, you know, it's like Cro-Magnon these days. I mean, you want a 70 MRI. But the funny thing about that is that in neurosurgery particularly, you know, we have the opportunity all the time to trial all these wonderful things. We do it all the time. And it's great and it's fabulous. And there's nothing like going into an operating theater and putting on a 3D headset and seeing everything in wonderful color, zooming in and out and all the rest of it. But at some time, I think it doesn't take very long for you to think, but what does it actually add to the whole thing? And I think an awful lot of the technology is a great idea, but it's looking for a cause in a lot of ways, you know? Yeah. So I think that's one thing. And the funny thing is the tremendous availability of technology, in a sense, forces you back to ask the simple questions, you know, really, and, you know, to try and focus your efforts on the things that have real and demonstrable value in a lot of ways. I mean, how do I guess that one way of just putting that is that, you know, my life is amazing. I mean, I every single day I get to use lasers and insanely powerful computers and scanners, ultrasound things. I have algorithms that allow me to predict things that you shouldn't be allowed to predict, you know, all this wonderful stuff. But the one thing that I think about a lot these days, particularly as I grow older, is that the vast majority of the children, the very great majority of children in this world, on this planet, most of them brown-skinned, will never, ever have the advantage of these things in their lives. You know, and I feel that very, very deeply. And I feel it as a great societal and personal failure, actually, in a lot of ways. And, you know, as I kind of like get into the last 10 years or so of, you know, probably my professional life, I guess, I increasingly feel the need to look back to the things that make enormous amounts of difference and could be perhaps deployed elsewhere. So, you know, I'm part of an initiative at the moment, you know, looking at doing exactly this and looking at using high-tech solutions in low-resource environments. Epilepsy surgery, for example, quite a difficult thing to do, but it's one operation that could make a child independent seizures for their entire life. Imagine if you could do that for 100,000 kids, someone like Kenya, what a difference that would make. Can you do it? Yes, you can. Is it high tech? Yes, it can be. How do you achieve it? Well, you know, a lot of the solutions are political in this environment. You know, most Western nations have enormous overseas development budgets, but more often than not, they get used for vanity projects and things that don't actually usefully, in a utilitarian sense, you know, provide the best outcome for the largest number of people. And I think that, you know, one can look at these problems morally, and one can look at them politically and fiscally as well. And I think there's a lot of work to do there, really. And I think that, you know, when you spend some time thinking about what's important in all this, you know, the questions are really quite straightforward ones, even though some of the answers are technologically very, very complex, you know. People say neurosurgery is very complex. Actually, it's not. I don't think it is. I think a lot of it's about decision making. We have wonderful toys, and that's great, you know, but a lot of it is, you know, relatively straightforward, I think.
I think, like, you bring in something lovely there though, Mike. I think that, you know, this is about, it's about not just neurosurgery, is it, or like how neurosurgery interacts with neuropsychology. It's about how do we interact with government, with politics, with policy, with health economics, with epidemiology, and how do we bring all of that together for the greater good?
Well, you know, medicine is nothing if not a political activity. It's a tremendously political activity. It always will be. It's expensive. You know, I've forever been massively in awe of and impressed by the National Health Service, and there really isn't anything else like it in the world. But the reason for that is it's not primarily a healthcare system, as you would have a healthcare corporation in North America, for example. Talk about these things there, you know. It's a social movement, And it was set up as such in 1947. It was designed so that people, no one individual, had to bear the burden of cost of illness, which will affect all of us. And that's, you know, the, you know, Aneurin Bevan's vision of how the health service would work, and because it was a joint social enterprise which we all gained, contributed to, but all gained from, I think is very, it's sustained me for many, many years, really. And this partially why behind, I don't really recognize this tremendous division between us and them in this environment. We're all part of the same thing, trying to look out for each other, you know? I was just speaking to Ingram a little while ago, actually, about your colleague, Narendra Kapoor, who is, in fact, somebody who's very... I know Narendra very well because he was in Southampton when I was a trainee there, and he was, you know, he's differently motivated as well. You know, he's one of the great Punjabi-Irish Raj, so he is. And he, you know, he's always described himself as a Gandhian, and he brings those principles to his work and his worldview. And I think that's always been inspiring, actually.
Long-term listeners to the Neuro podcast, and there are many, Mike, will be expecting some levity, some talk
about please.
Dogs and bass guitar and quizzes and things like that.
Quizzes, yes.
Well, people might want to know, we had some slight technical issues, didn't we? And we're all
sitting we certainly did
with the sun setting. So I think we should finish on the big questions, Mike, that you've opened up towards the end there. But I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today, and particularly generous on the back of a good half hour, 40 minutes of grappling with the intricacies of Zoom, sharing your stories of becoming a neurosurgeon, what it is to do neurosurgery, and what it is to interface with a group of very excellent colleagues, one in particular. So I'm very grateful to you, Mike.
You're very welcome.
It's thank you.
Great pleasure.
Thank you so much. And I'm definitely coming to Bristol.